and welcome back to the campsite. I'm Jack, here with my co-hosts Tim and John. We got, as always, Ron on the Wands and Twos.
Wand on the Rons and Twos, baby.
And joining us around the campfire this evening is my beautiful partner, Jenna, here to discuss motherhood and capitalism. How you doing, Jenna?
You know, I'm doing really well. Tummy's full, so that's always good. Got to cook in some cast iron, so it really felt like we were around the campfire.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Thank ambience. You for that, by the way. Yes. It was delicious.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So, I guess I'll just introduce myself to the listeners at home. Like Jack said, my name is Jenna, and I am a longtime activist who turned stay-at-home mom. Before, my activism included recycling programs that I got started in a couple of small towns. My embarrassingly, first passionate speech was about the importance of climate change all the way back in 2002, because my mother had purchased the National Geographic magazines, and I had read through them, and I was absolutely horrified at what I was reading, and nobody cared, and people still don't care. It's okay. It's a whole thing. So I also did disaster relief volunteering in Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and again went back in 2006, and also volunteered with Hurricane Ike in 2008. I also briefly attended Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park in March and April of 2011, and although those are my highlights, my activism isn't over because I believe that it can't be over, right?
No. Yeah, we definitely talk about that. The stakes are too high for people to disengage.
Definitely. Because I find myself in a different position, I have shifted my priorities away from these grand scale movements to trying to organize locally and figure out what exactly that looks like, so that we're meeting people where they are. I think that it's important to add a disclaimer here, just that my perspective today comes from a cisgender, straight passing, biologically fertile white individual. And so if I go on a tangent and it feels like I'm excluding a group, or sometimes if your struggle isn't my struggle, I don't want it to come across like I'm downplaying that. That is not my intention at all, because my experience is just limited to my own material conditions. And I absolutely acknowledge my place of privilege in this world. So, you know, guys, if you hear something today and you see it as a blind spot, feel free to call it out. Let's talk about it, because I want to further the conversation instead of it just being this massive circle jerk of stroking each other's egos.
Absolutely. Email Ron about it very angrily.
I would
and
love
Ron will read he will read all of your emails in a mocking tone.
The email address is mikepence@whitehouse.gov.
It's perfect.
Yeah. That's where you should send the complaints.
We will absolutely get to them. So.
I do like that you mentioned people who are unable to have children, because I think that's a lot of, they really fall to the wayside a lot of times in conversations, because there's all so many other marginalized groups.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people don't realize that, that's a major issue that other people are struggling with. And that's something that I've come to realize a lot recently with a couple different people that I know really well. So that's good.
And it's so much more common than people tend to even think, because there is this need to just stuff it down and don't talk about your struggles and just be thankful that you don't have it worse than other people. But fertility issues, when you're told suffer in silence, it's so much worse. And I think that the internet is doing great at making it so that people can tell their stories and find that healing and that community and that comfort that this issue holds, because you aren't just a mother because you carry a baby and deliver a baby. There are so many ways to be a mother.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. And Yeah. My heart breaks for people who have had to go at it alone.
Yeah, that is brutal. And it's so interesting that you mentioned suffering in silence, because if there was ever just a thesis for, like, how capitalist society kind of tailors people's grief and makes them, like, kind of forces them to process their grief and their issues, that's so much it. It's like, everything is a personal failing. Everything is a moral failing. Mm-hmm. Even things that obviously can't be, like, your biological makeup. So it just becomes this idea of, like, you don't want people to build solidarity with each other, so you make them suffer in silence. And I think that we do that to parents a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, we do that to people, a lot of marginalized groups, infertile people or anything, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, to say capitalism is not kind to people is a very valid statement. And
yeah, say the least.
The statement capitalism has not been kind to mothers is an even more powerful statement. And it's something that I feel passionate about. And I mean, I feel like I have so much to say, and I'm such a chatterbox. Ron, you're going to have to keep us on time, because I'm probably going to just, I think that it's so important to know. And like, if you don't know a whole lot, or you're just now want to, you know, look into this topic, I think that a great like recommendation is to read the doctorate thesis that turned book by Silvia Federici, which is Caliban and the Witch.
Okay.
I think that once I read that book, it made a lot of I connected a lot of points that I otherwise would not have connected. And, you know, we can't talk about these issues if we don't have the historical context to make all of these things make sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Caliban and the Witch. I have not... Is a history of the body in transition to capitalism. Oh, wow. Okay. Federici. Interesting.
Yeah, a couple episodes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've mentioned Silvia Federici before. Yeah. Sure. So
she's amazing. She really is.
Marxist feminist academics are an interesting bunch. And man, like if I ever just need like a basic template for like how to approach something materially, like that's where I go for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and her analysis in like Caliban and the Witch is a lot of primary sources, which I really like about it. Like, she is clearly a scholar who's gone back and has looked at like as close to a primary source as she can for things that are in like the 1400s and 1500s. So it's extremely well researched, and it kind of dispels a lot of myths that have been brought up around like, especially the traditional family and the family unit, which is today, you know, it's a big calling card of the right talking about having to defend the traditional family, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this is like, you know, I think that we have to have this conversation start in the past. And like, I would argue that like the start of it all, like downfall of it all, if you will, was enclosure. And so I thought that it might be interesting if Jack, like, explains enclosure, like, briefly, just so that we kind of have the historical context of it and then can go from there.
Sweet.
So enclosure was a series of laws, initially a series of laws that were passed in England, in the Kingdom of England. So not Great Britain as we understand it today, but just in the south of England there, south of Scotland. In like the 1314 and 1500s. And it was a long process that essentially made it illegal to live as a peasant. And this was done after the rich merchants and landowners kind of captured the levers of the new parliament in England. Surprise, surprise. And the purpose of these laws was to make it so that people would not have any choice but to work for a wage. Because at the time, working for a wage meant that you were not a part of any community that would help you to subsist without money. So if you were a well-embedded part and a useful part of a village, you didn't really need to have a lot of, you know, a lot of money. You didn't have to pay rent on your cottage. You didn't have to, you know, I mean, of course, like, there were feudal relations where people had to give up a certain percentage of their harvest, but taxes were collected twice a year, and taxes were paid in grain, or they, you know, they weren't paid in money. So the transition from that feudal agrarian economy to a capitalist economy required people to be disconnected from their ability to eat for free and to house themselves for free. And the way that medieval peasants did that was simply by going on to what were called the commons, or the common land, the forests and the meadows where they grazed their livestock, that were, under the feudal order, technically owned, quote-unquote, by the aristocrats, but they... the people were allowed to use it, and there was a common law that the aristocrats were not allowed to fence off more than what was their palaces, their manors, their lands. They weren't allowed to erect excluding fences from forests, from meadows, from things like that. And the enclosure laws actually allowed them to literally enclose their land in with fences and hedgerows and kind of parcel it out and sell it off bit by bit. Or use it to, you know, charge people rent to use it and things like that. So broadly, enclosure was the transition from having a peasant class to having a proletarian class that were landless and had no ability to grow their own food, were legally not allowed to build their own houses, things like that. And under that process... because, like, that definition that I just gave is basically what Marx would say enclosure was, leading up to industrial capitalism. But Silvia Federici in Caliban and the Witch argues that during the process of enclosure, women were actually enclosed into homes. They were enclosed into houses because previously, under the feudal order, women and men both worked inside and outside of the home. And there was not, like, the traditional, quote-unquote, division of labor between men and women. And it was during the transition to capitalism that women were shut inside of homes and not allowed outside.
Fully forced into domestic life.
Yeah, fully forced into domestic
with
servitude.
With the punishment of death if you didn't comply. Damn.
Yes, the best, man, that's, yeah, I was about to say, that's... You know, nothing says freedom and free enterprise and the invisible hand of the free market like 3 centuries of laws forcing people into very specific societal boxes from the top down.
Yep.
Very cool. You know, stateless capitalism is definitely coming any day now.
We just got to hold out hope, guys.
Yeah, guys.
Hold
yeah,
out
we're going to have that libertarian society. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's just... You know, you hear about enclosure, and you see where it becomes the downfall. Like,
absolutely.
You couldn't just go and forage in the forest, because a huge part of enclosure was actually tearing down ancient food forests, so that you had no choice but to engage in wage labor.
Right. Those are the only place you could get food at
exactly.
that point, right? It was from the fields. You couldn't go forage in that.
Well, and especially with, you know, capitalism and needing to make money, monoculture crops became much more popular because you were able to, you know, have a good year with wheat and tell everybody that, oh, guess what you're having? You're having bread for dinner every single night this week. And
hell yeah, brother.
It's, I mean, not obviously great. Like, yeah. I mean, we white people, we do love our bread.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
Do.
I was about to say, nobody was really doing the keto thing back then, I guess.
No,
so.
No.
They're just like, we ain't had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days.
It was exactly like that.
Yeah. Except it was like 3 months during the winter. Yeah.
God.
Good stuff.
Yeah. I think that it's really sad when I hear, you know, about enclosure, because I just think about if you had all of this land that was the commons, there had to be an area where you knew you could go and visit the grave sites of your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mothers obviously didn't have like perfect survival rates of kids.
Right.
And so, like, in losing the commons, there were people who also lost their connection to people who had passed and lost the connection to medicinal plants.
Yeah, it's weird to think, right? So, like, there were not necessarily public cemeteries back then where people just buried in the woods, were like in makeshift cemeteries.
Cities there were official cemeteries, you know,
but out in the country, cities, yeah,
yeah, not out in the country.
I mean, just even in this country, you don't have to put somebody in a cemetery.
No, that's true.
You literally can bury somebody as long as you know everybody knows. You can't just have bodies.
Be more efficient today. I think Tim and I are just both trying to picture here, like the disposal method, I guess, if you will. Like, I know, right. Like if you go back to the plague times, you have people just carting like whole carts of bodies away and burning them.
Stuff like that. Yeah, I don't imagine it was as consistent back then. Yeah,
maybe a couple hundred years later.
Well, I'm also what I'm wondering is like, probably technically you can, but would do you think that like the bureau? I guess it would depend on where you live. We're 50 little countries, but like, if I just wanted to like bury my old mom in the backyard, do you think that they would? I would imagine they would make that very challenging for me to do. There'd have to be all kinds of permits. And...
There are permits. It is, like, more challenging. Obviously, I mean, you know, you could get serial killers that way.
Right.
If you're just like, no, it's my family. It's cemetery it's for my family. Dear old dad.
Yeah.
Like,
soup for my family. Yeah. Primordial soup of my family.
Yeah. So,
Well, and it's interesting that you bring up permits because some of the enclosure laws required a permit to do things. You know, it wasn't that the things were explicitly outlawed, but you had to get a permit to do it.
Which is very hard or impossible to get.
If you are a peasant and literally have no money.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. It's crazy because, you know, before enclosure, you just did what you were best at and, like, you just concentrated on survival, which I think is weird because capitalists paint that as, like, this gotcha moment. Right, they're like, oh, like imagine all the progress and the art and like all of the communities and like what are you gonna do if you can't choose between like 27 brands of cereal or whatever?
Right. Well, but you can choose is what you actually want to do with your life or what you actually can do with your life to build a cooperative society where everybody's needs are met.
Yeah, and I think it's like the progress myth to say that these communities didn't have art or didn't have music or didn't have like robust cultural celebrations.
Yeah, they absolutely did.
And like these celebrations, especially like how the Christians appropriated a lot of pagan traditions to fit their needs. Like, there's so much of our culture that has just been lost.
Oh, yeah.
And I find that very telling because we're all just kind of, like, shambling about trying to find our purpose in life. And it's almost because we don't know where we come from.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, like, again, you talk about just, like, so much of keeping capitalism, you know, as the game in town, and so much of keeping people complacent in this system of exploitation is making sure they don't really know their history. They know maybe a very kind of whitewashed, watered down, propagandic version of it, but they don't know what they don't know. Like I had never heard of enclosure laws before, you know, this podcast started. Like I didn't know the extent of that even. Like, especially that era of history, like, what do we freaking learn about? We learn about the Enlightenment, we learn about the plague. Like, we don't learn about, like, how...
It's the dark times, quote-unquote.
Yeah, and we don't talk about, like, why that was the dark times, or, like, how we... Like, what that created, and, like, how that created the modern world. Like, we especially, like, my God, in, like, high school, secondary... They really do be, like, starting on the Enlightenment and acting like that was the beginning of, like, society as we know it. But, like...
Well, don't you know? The enclosure laws pulled these dirty heathens out of their uncultured times and moved them towards progress.
Oh, damn. I was wrong. I'm sorry. Forget everything I just said.
I recently read this big, long thing talking about how during the Dark Ages there was, like, a lot of different things, like, innovations that were created that are still, you know, in use today. But when we think back at those times, we don't think, like, oh, they made ice.
Right.
Yeah.
They had queen bathhouses. They could, you know.
Even like a root cellar is such a cool concept. You literally dig down below the frost line. The temperature is always the same. You can store vegetables there, and you can store eggs there, and you can hang meat in there, and like all of these methods that we're just now coming back to because I feel like our generation realizes, oh crap. We need to figure out what we're going to do. We need to look back to these old methods to see how we're going to even figure this out. I just...
Oh, come on. This is going to last forever. It's going to be fine.
just
everything
just
we're
bye,
doing
baby.
Is very sustainable.
Bye, baby.
We're all going to have this great electricity and clean water forever.
You know, I recycled a can today. I did my part.
You did.
One camp.
You know, all right, well, mission accomplished, everybody. We can go home.
I've been recycling like crazy because I could not do that like in my last couple places that I've lived. And
yeah.
Finally got the city to drop off one of those enormous recycling bins. So like we go through like all the trash, anything we can recycle goes out in the bin. It's been nice.
It is important. It really is. I'm not saying that you shouldn't recycle, but we're so past recycling, guys.
Yeah, we're so past individual action. It's, yeah. So, at some point, these enclosure laws really, well, not at some point, but they really affected, women got the brunt of it, you would say?
Oh, yeah. Well, after
okay,
enclosure,
that makes sense. All right.
There was so much less what? Community,
when
right?
have women ever gotten the brunt of anything in history? Come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, even just, there were more unintended pregnancies in this time because you take away women's abilities to go out and forage for plants. I can name two right now, blue cohosh and red raspberry leaf. Do not drink if you're pregnant and want to be pregnant because it can cause you to lose the pregnancy. And if you make it so that foraging is punishable by death, you are going to be pregnant because here's the thing about enclosure. It made it so that women could not be independent from a man because they couldn't make a wage. They weren't allowed to own property often. And so you have to just accept whatever abuse a man decides that he's going to inflict on you.
Yeah.
It's,
which I would guess in many cases was those unintended pregnancies.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that that also led to the population boom at the time as well?
Well, yeah. So, like, part of the enclosure of women in houses and the... because a lot of what witchcraft, quote-unquote, was, mm-hmm. was herbalism. It was knowing what specific herbs did what for, you know, traditional folk medicine, right? And like Jenna just said, the taking away the abortificent herbs from the women that had been passed down through generations of knowledge from mom to daughter, and not allowing them to do that anymore created the conditions for a population boom. And that was done on purpose because you had to have a lot of really poor, destitute people that were willing to go and work in the factories. Because at the time, working in a factory was like a fate worse than fucking death.
Truly.
And people would not do it unless they literally had to do it to provide food for their babies.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. And the people who built those factories knew that. And they lobbied the government to make it so that there would be massive poverty and a large pool of people that they could easily exploit. So, yeah, absolutely.
And
it did create the population.
I think to add to that, right, is that this concept was give each working man their own submissive, their own subordinate, to give them just like a taste of power. So you're powerless where you're working, but you can come home and be the king of your castle or whatever dumb analogy you want to put with it. And you know, you are told, like, especially like manly men keep their women and their children in line.
Yeah.
And I think that it's, you know, this effort to say, like, just punch down, right? Just punch down, you know, if you don't have the time or the energy to go after your boss because mm-hmm. you're dead on your feet and working for pennies, then Empire benefits from this.
Absolutely.
And Empire knew how detrimental it was going to be when they did this, especially with, you know, how difficult it was to get a divorce, impossible it was to get a divorce versus now. And it ensured that women had to stay in these awful relationships and ensured that bodies kept showing up for work. It ensured the next generation of workers was just as destitute as their parents. And oftentimes it made mothers have to make a really hard choice of how they were going to feed all these damn kids they were forced to have. And oftentimes, like, mothers would send their children to factories because capitalism doesn't give a fuck about kids.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned it was like the 1-2 punch between like what Jack said and what you said, where it's like, first they did the material warfare on the peasants and on the poor. They took away their ability to get those, you know, those abortion meds, basically, in the forest. They took away their ability to forage. They took away their ability. And then, you're right, then you enter that psychological warfare of, like, we are going to take everything from you and then give you a single subordinate to take all of it out on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to cause a divide. And you're going to have all these kids that you're anchored down by. And that's, you know, and again, that are very, they're supposed to be subordinate and submissive to you. So again, you create these hierarchies within the working class. It's the same way empire creates hierarchies in their colonies. You know, I was just thinking the other day about, like, the Hutus and the Tutsis or any other group, where it's just like, if you create a hierarchy within the people you're subjugating, then they're fighting each other or dealing with each other's shit instead of fighting you. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's super interesting to look at the fact that when the English went on to colonize the entire world, they used the same tactics on the people they were colonizing as they initially used on their own people to turn them from peasants into proles. Like that, like, yeah, the first experiment was in England, and then they found out, wow, this works really well.
On their own people, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the next thing that I wanted to talk about, it's pretty brutal, I'm not gonna lie. It is pretty brutal, guys. So if you are squeamish,
Content warning.
Content warning. It deals with birth. Okay.
All right.
So, in the late 1800s, in the beginning of the 1900s, doctors were experimenting with something called twilight birth, which is honestly horrifying.
So, do the kids come out sparkly? And...
beautiful vampires, yeah, right?
Very broody.
the coif of hair. No, but essentially, women would begin labor at home, and then they would be brought to the hospital, and they were given an injection of happy fun morphine, and it's S-C-O-P-O-L-A-M-I-N-E. Scopolamine. Yeah. Okay. Does anyone know what scopolamine does?
No. Not
okay.
Idea.
So it prevents your brain from forming memories, but does absolutely nothing for pain.
Jesus Christ.
So
they were just making them forget all that horrible pain.
No, wait a second. No, wait a second. Because you got the one little hit of morphine that you remembered. You're like, oh, I came in. They made me feel good. And then the fun began, right? So you're in labor. You're in full-blown labor. You cannot remember anything, and you're hopped up on drugs, and you're a massive fall hazard, right?
Yeah.
So, to reduce the screaming and, like, the thrashing of women during labor, women were restrained to a padded bed using leather straps, and they were placed in dark rooms. The dark room was to prevent stimuli from further exciting them, but they're screaming, and I find it interesting, before you would give birth, like, in your house, right? And, like, your husband would hear what was going on, obviously. They didn't let them anywhere near the hospital, because if men found out that their wives' eyes were being covered with gauze to eliminate their sight, and that their ears were being plugged with oil-soaked cotton in order to eliminate their hearing,
Jesus.
And they were screaming, and they were crying, and they're feeling all of the pain with the delivery. I mean, imagine having an episiotomy, which is where the doctor makes a small cut to assist the baby's head exiting.
For sure.
You feel that, but you're not remembering it, right? Except medical dosing is tricky, and
uh-oh.
If the cocktail's not mixed perfectly, you would remember. You would remember being tied down. You would remember being in excruciating pain. You would remember the doctors performing all of the procedures without offering you any numbing agent, because you won't remember.
Who cares? Yeah.
And imagine, like, being in that situation, and your nurse and your doctor are showing you no compassion. So this process became this automated process, and obviously it's great that we no longer do that, but I think that this scar can still be seen within obstetrics practices. And 33% of births in this country end in a cesarean section?
Like currently?
Currently.
Gotcha.
I just found that out the other day. I also 33. Found out what you were talking about with a small incision to assist with the birth. They would do something called the husband stitch, where the doctor would go in and stitch it up a little bit tighter than it should have been.
And it causes excruciating pain for the woman to have sex. But hey, your husband likes it better, right?
Nice.
It's just...
Dudes rock.
It's sickening. It really is sickening. Yeah,
it's horrifying. No, to be clear, it's horrifying. And now, I have a question real quick, because looking back on that. Now, would they overcorrect sometimes and, I don't know, kill the women with these drugs? I have to imagine that happened, too.
Absolutely.
I was thinking, like, it's one thing to pull back too much and then, like, oh, no, they can feel everything. But I'm like, what happens if you give them too much?
Oh, yes. That they was die? A that huge...
stillbirth in some circumstances?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because trauma during the birthing process, like... If you look at any other animal, when they go into labor, they will go and find a quiet, dark spot and just want to be alone. But we're humans. We have verbal skills. We're different, obviously, than animals. We have empathy and we want others to show us empathy.
Right.
And so there are things that I understand, especially first-time labor, because you don't know what to expect. You're like, oh, it's getting worse. How much worse is it going to get? I would like to preface that I personally have made the choice to opt for as little medical interventions as possible. But even that, I received some medical interventions, but I did not take the epidural and I did not take pain medicine. And it was a lot easier after my first to be like, oh, I got this. Even if my second one is worse.
Sure.
It's just...
You know what to expect, at least. And it's you've gone through the process. Yes. Sure.
And
okay.
It's interesting because we don't really talk about the process of birth. We don't talk about the amazing feats that women's bodies go through to keep the earth populated with more people. And... It shouldn't be mind-blowing information, any of this, right? Like, no. You should know the process just because, like, you two are a human, and to be brought into this world, you had to. But, you know, in capitalism, if it doesn't affect you, baby, don't pay it any mind.
Right. I mean, it's amazing how little I understand about, like, and I mean, like, I'm a almost 30-year-old man, but, like, I've never, I don't know anything about this process. Nobody ever, like, really, like, you know, you learn about the basics of it in health class when you're set in, you know, sixth and seventh grade, but
at that great schooling.
Yeah. All that really, yeah. All those really great, you know, absence only programs and stuff that did a great job on childbirth. Like, yeah, the fact that, like, but not only that, like, I know fuck all about childbirth currently, but like the fact that, like, that horrifying history is not something we are, like, talking about, like, yo, remember how bad this used to be?
Yeah, and the fact that it is still affecting current doctors' mindsets.
Oh, yeah.
I, like, for instance, Black and brown women, pregnant women, receive care that is nothing short of malicious. It wasn't even until 2007 that all states added the standardized maternal mortality checkbox to their vital registration systems. So you could die in childbirth in 2016 and you would not be listed as a cause of death. So this thing that is causing all of these women to die is not even being talked about within the government system. So how can we even, you know, how could the government know that hospitals were having this problem?
Gee, it's almost like that was by design.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, it's crazy because, like, hard numbers are that in the UK, a Black woman is five times more likely to die in childbirth. And sure, this year progress has been made to lower the numbers of 3 times to 4 times in the United States. But this is still absolutely obscene, and it just, it can't go on any longer.
So wait, it's worse in the UK for black women than it is in the United States?
It is.
Wow. That's,
Jesus.
That's really surprising.
Yeah, especially since they have an NHS and stuff. Like, that's, Jesus.
And, you know, it's because of all of this misinformation. Like, are you aware of what is called, I don't know the exact definition, but it's like the medical model. In all medical procedures and like trials, they are looking at what happens to white male bodies. Yeah. And a lot of the pregnancy information that we have right now is based on white male bodies. How does that make any sense?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Like, even, like, this comes down to, like, issues that, like, women of color face. Not just, like, you know, reproductive issues, but, like, hey, that's a different color. That wound is going to be a different color on a black person's skin, or that cancer, than it would be on a white person's skin. But, like, the book says, oh, no, it's not that color, so it can't be that. And it's, like... It's like a real disturbingly like common issue that like people of color face in this country, in medical issue. That's a, I totally forgot about that. That's like a very real thing. Yeah.
I mean,
I didn't know what it was called, but okay. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Sure.
Women should be able to go into a hospital and give birth regardless of color, creed, orientation, any of that. It's supposed to be this like place you receive care, but capitalism has twisted healthcare from being a vital function of any society to a way to profit. Yeah. And if they think you're not going to pay your bill, like, you're going to be treated differently.
Oh, yeah.
And I just, it makes me sick.
Well, and childbirth used to be a community ritual.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, there were the older women who knew what it was about, knew the preparations to
make. And
it
still hurt, baby. Yeah. We're not saying that it was this magical experience, because it's birth. It is gritty and real, but it was definitely communal.
Yeah, and then like the medicalization of it didn't come until those communities of women that upheld each other had been forcefully stamped out. And then they were like, oh shit, what do we do about childbirth? I guess we'll let the doctors handle it.
Absolutely. And I think that that's so telling, because it went from this community of women to these obstetricians who are male.
All men. Yeah, 100% back then. Yeah.
And just now we're finally getting women who are, you know, becoming, having doctor in front of their name, but it still doesn't change the fact that if you go into a practice and there is a man on the team, but you have been seeing the woman and you give birth at the wrong time and she's not there, here comes some guy you've never met before.
Yep.
Coming to catch your baby, coming to tell you what you're going to do. I mean, and you have these rights, like the episiotomy, right? You do not have to consent to an episiotomy. And oftentimes, if you get an episiotomy, you tear anyway. So, like, the new, like, train of thought is, okay, you should just allow the birthing process, natural tearing, to happen, unless there's fetal distress, and then that's a different game, right? Sure. We want babies to be alive.
Right.
But, you know, let this happen, because the healing is so much better. But doctors are not required to all think the same things. They're not required to, there's no, like, standardized, okay, like, we've discovered this thing, let's all stop doing it. So really knowing what your rights are, and even if you are, you know, sitting here listening today and you're like, I'm a man, when is this ever going to bother me? Do you not have a sister? Do you not have, you know, a friend who is planning on giving birth?
You at least have a biological mother.
And yeah, we should know, we should all know what rights we have when it comes to childbirth, so that we can make medically informed decisions that are right for us, instead of just placing our hands and our children and our bodies into the hands of people who are really, honestly, and I know that this is like cynical, but doctors have to cover their own rears.
Oh, yeah.
They do. They don't have a choice.
Liability
is,
and it's messing the whole system up. It just is. And
Absolutely. Well, it's just, it's so funny that you're, it's just interesting that you say, like, well, if you're, a, you know, a person with a penis, you know, this isn't necessarily going to affect you or whatever. But it's like, you never know when your future wife, girlfriend, whatever, may be in childbirth and may be physically indisposed, and you may have to advocate on their behalf because they can't. So just because you think, and you know, it's like, even if you're not planning on having kids like me or whatever, like, you just never know what kind of position you're going to end up in. You're right, a sister, a family member, a daughter, a niece, whatever, that's like, somebody's got to stand up and be like, hey, this is, they're within their rights for this, and you need to give it to them, or no, you can't just do this without, you know, their consent. And
yeah,
they will just absolutely do or not do things if they feel that it's, you know, they, whatever reason, have decided to do or not do things.
And it's not even, like, malicious in intent, right? There are only so many nurses working the floor, and if you are having a natural childbirth without pain remedies, you're going to be utilizing a lot more methods of pain, what's management. The word I'm management. Thank you. So you're going to be moving around a lot, and you're going to be making a lot more sounds, and you're going to need somebody checking in on you more. And if a nurse is like, I have an absolutely full floor, and okay, I'm going to go, and I haven't peed in 6 hours, really would like to do that in the next two,
yeah.
You know, you are turning this, because capitalism says we're only going to pay for there to be 4 nurses on the floor, because we don't want to overpay.
God
forbid.
What if there's
we're
overstaffed, which, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. When people's lives are at stake, that's what we're all worried about, that there are going to be too many people there to help them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, because you're using these natural, I don't even want to say natural, because you're using these pain management techniques, you become more of a liability, because most of the time, like, how it's done in hospitals, like, how birth is done in hospitals, is you come in, you have to labor hard until you reach 4 centimeters dilated, which is like that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
The listeners can't see what I'm doing.
That's okay. I know what you mean.
It's pretty big, okay?
Yeah.
Before, and you have to be 4 centimeters.
Yeah, do the A-OK with your hand, and it's like, there you are. Bada bing.
Yeah, don't do white power. That's
oh, bad. No, the bottom one. The ha-ha made you look. Now I'm going to punch your arm. Like,
there you go.
Ha-ha, you just looked at my nuts. It's about that size. Yeah. You guys know what I'm talking. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Yes.
So that is the point of which you will be offered an epidural.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, now, you made the nurse look, and now you get to punch them and they get an epidural. That's
so, and it is. It's horrible. But
it doesn't sound fun.
No, it's awful. But then you also can't be too far along. Like, I have a friend who had a baby, and she went in at 9 centimeters, and they were like, you don't get an epidural, even though that was her plan.
Uh-oh.
So you have this, you know, this window of where you'll be administered an epidural, and follow me this way. We're going to go right over here, and you're going to lay down, and you're going to take a nap with an epidural. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. Then we're going to wake you up when it's time to push the baby out. How much easier is that for the hospital?
Sure.
Than this woman who's, I mean, just primal and growling and, quite frankly, I probably scared some individuals. I can acknowledge that.
It happens.
So it's just interesting how capitalism has just shaped, like, the way we give birth. I just think that that's so interesting. And you look back on the history of all of this and you're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Excellent. Yeah, good stuff. You love watching the entire fabric of community as we know it completely break down for profit, down to literally the process of giving life. It's beautiful.
Well, because, I mean, strong communities resist capitalism. They always have.
Yeah.
You know, strong communities are antithetical to a capitalist approach to life, which is every man for himself.
Sure. Absolutely. So we're down to about our last 5 minutes of this episode here. I'd love to do a two-parter. I know you've got a lot of info, and I figure this is such an important topic, and it seems like, just even just in the chat when Jack explained it, I was like, oh, we should do that as a two-parter. So is there any, like, good place to leave this one that, like, would be a good, like, ending for this kind of, historical analysis before we really move into like where we're at now.
So I think that everyone should know where we come from. Should know where we come from a historical perspective. Should know the things that our mothers have gone through to bring us onto this beautiful earth. The thing to know how we got here is important to better where we are going. And there is no way for us to talk about the human race's future without mothers being in the forefront. Without mothers in the forefront, there will be no more humans.
Yeah, it's kind of really patient zero, the whole thing, isn't it?
It really is. And we have been so disrespectful to our mothers for so long. We have allowed atrocities to happen to women. And I think that we can learn, and there are great resources out there and books, and there are podcasts of like with like historical context, and I wish I had written down a couple of podcasts, but I know that there's one, it's like 13 Moons, I want to say. She does this really great podcast about especially like what it is to be a woman, right?
Nice.
And I should say what it is to be a biological woman. That is like what her focus is. It does not include, at least from what I heard, it does not include trans women, which we need to have a conversation about trans women mothers in this too. Right?
In part two?
You matter. You matter, part two.
Yes, I'm so ready for it in part two. Sounds great.
I really hope that you guys liked the historical context that we brought into this before we like dive into all of the other stuff, and we're gonna try and keep it to a part two, but I have so much to say. It's a lot.
Well, and that's the beauty of it, is you can always come back for a part three at some point.
Bring more delicious food.
Yeah, I'm down. I'm definitely down with that. So Jack, do you wanna guide us out here?
Yes. So that was our episode, folks. Thanks for joining us today, and on our honor, we will do our best to smash capitalism.
Mm.
Bye-bye.